Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Some big tech companies that once welcomed internal dissent and debate appear to be changing tack. Google and Amazon employees say their activism has drawn negative attention from the employers, which have responded with firings and threats of firing. Colin Letcher is a senior reporter at The Verge. He covers government technology policy and employee activism in the tech industry. Welcome to the show, Colin.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Weren't tech companies like Google known for being open and receptive to employees' concerns, kind of thinking outside the box, that sort of thing?
Yeah, that's definitely a reputation that especially Google has had for a very long time. I think that's something that they even used to draw in employees. They said, look, this is a place where your voice will be heard. We're really a democratic institution. If you see something that doesn't seem right, we want you to speak up and say it. Their internal policies even mention something along those lines. But more recently, we've seen management, like you said, seeming to be a little losing patience with that idea.
Why? I mean, aren't they big enough to, you know, handle a couple mosquitoes?
It's more than just a couple people at this point. I mean, last year there was a walkout at Google protesting the company's handling of sexual harassment allegations. And at that time, it was thousands of people that were participating in a walkout. And we were seeing similar actions at Amazon in 2019, where thousands of employees also walked out to show support for the climate protests that were happening at the same time. So you can see that this isn't just a couple of people sending emails back and forth. It's really a large-scale event that's happening right now.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about how big tech is responding to protests, activism among its rank and file. My guest is Colin Letcher. He is a senior reporter for The Verge. He covers government tech policy and employee activism. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Are we mostly talking about big tech here, or are there different iterations of startups that are starting to, you know, push back on that, the reputation of, you know, freewheeling and anything goes?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's really sort of been happening in a top-down way, and you're starting to see it trickle down to some of the smaller companies. So I think it's fair to say Google employees really started the first wave, and then we saw similar activism happening at Amazon, at Microsoft, like you said, sort of the big companies. But recently, that's gone down to companies like GitHub, which was recently acquired by Microsoft, but which is sort of a smaller software development company, and they were protesting the company's relationship with ICE, saying that they disagreed with the Trump administration's immigration policies. So I think in the next year especially, you're going to see more and more startups, even further down in the chain, smaller and smaller, sort of taking a stand on what they don't see as right.
What about the allegations of shorter and fewer staff meetings and stricter corporate communication policies for rank and file? Is that another manifestation?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think one big signpost recently was Google CEO Sundar Pichai saying he was going to be limiting the weekly meetings that Google was kind of known for to set the scene a little bit. Google has for years had these sort of famous meetings called TGIF. And they're just weekly meetings where, you know, the rank and file employees can hear from management. They get a chance to hear what's going on. They get a chance to ask questions. But recently, the CEO came out and said, we're going to scale those back. We're going to say we're going to move those to monthly meetings, and they're going to be explicitly focused on product and business strategy. So, you know, immediately the people who are involved with activism are saying, oh, this was one of our only outlets to maybe question management about, say, political policies, and now we're having that restricted.
And how has management responded to all of these allegations?
Management has responded, I think, pretty uniformly, saying, look, these are people who broke our policies in some way. They maybe talked to the media when they weren't authorized to. They maybe provided information that was supposed to be only internal. And the employees, I should say, dispute that. They say, you know, we didn't do anything. We were just talking with reporters about working conditions, which is totally our legal right to do so. But management says, look, these aren't new policies. I think that some of them would probably dispute that there's a crackdown happening. They said these are long-standing policies that these employees broke.
A handful of Google employees said they were ousted for protesting a controversial project in China. And the company says that wasn't the reason. The employees are fighting their dismissal. And I'm wondering, what sorts of rights do employees have with these companies?
Yeah, so employees, speaking very generally, you know, employees have the right to talk about their working conditions. You know, an employer can't step in and stop them from talking about what their situation is like. Now, tech companies historically have been very protective of their intellectual property, of their confidential information, and have shown a real willingness to crack down when employees step over that line. Now, this is where the sort of dispute comes in, is where does that line between confidential information and working conditions end?
Mm-hmm.
But I think what you're seeing right now is management saying, oh, this stepped over the line of our policies, and employees are saying, we're just very reasonably talking about our working conditions, and that's a protected right. And in fact, the employees that you mentioned have filed charges, a sort of complaint with the National Labor Relations Board, saying we were fired unfairly and we had a protected right to do this.
Where is that headed? I mean, what are the expectations on that case?
You know, we really don't know. I mean, it's sort of a lot of it is sort of uncharted waters. I mean, there's obviously a lot of case law in general about employee rights, but I couldn't predict either way how it's going to shake out. Right now, it's just in the investigative stage. And so we'll see a little bit more as it continues this year.
I mean, they're not unionized, right?
They're not unionized, no. None of the big tech companies are. Some of the temporary vendors who do sort of outsourced work for mm-hmm. companies like Google are unionized, but mm-hmm. not the company as a whole, no.
A former top Google executive says the company is putting profits ahead of people. It's this guy who's running for U.S. Senate in May, Lajeunesse, I think is how you pronounce his name, Ross Lajeunesse. He said the company pushed him out for his advocacy on human rights violations and censorship. And I'm wondering, has this been sussed out as just politics? Is he, you know, on a bully pulpit now, or what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, I think there would probably be a dispute between him and what the company's official line would be about that. But what I would say is that this has been something that's been boiling for more than a decade now. So Ross Lajeunesse, which, as you explained, he joined the company 11 years ago. And at the time, Google was sort of considering entering China, which would have been a very controversial move because you have to employ strict censorship guidelines to be a part of the internet market there. And at the time in 2010, they said, okay, we're not going to do this. But recently that position changed. And in 2017, he found out that the company was in the stages of seemingly making plans to launch a censored Chinese search engine. And according to him, he raised the alarm bells. He said, this isn't right. We have very severe human rights concerns about this. It's something that we can't do. And he says he was basically overruled and sidelined from the project when he raised those concerns.
Is that Project Dragonfly that you're talking about?
Yep. So it was codenamed Project Dragonfly, and that's sort of how, when it was leaked to the media, it was mentioned when it came out.
We said the employees filed a complaint with the National Labor Relations Board. What sort of status do they have with that compared to the likes of Google?
I mean, ideally, that's sort of the place you go if you're an employee and you want to adjudicate these sorts of disputes. That's why it's there. So mm-hmm. an ideal system, you try to, you know, that's where the employee can go to have a voice.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, obviously, Google, this isn't the first time that Google has, it's a huge company, lots of huge companies have to face these sorts of complaints from time to time. Mm-hmm. And so they, you know, they're experienced doing that, and they'll have a battle to fight on it.
Right. But what about the employees? I mean, what are their resources like?
I believe they've gone with the Communication Workers Association
okay.
for representation on it. And so they, they're working with experienced people to sort of make the case for it.
Do you, what do you predict or what do you sense is ahead? Is it going to be more employees testing the waters, you know, pushing the buttons, seeing, you know, the envelope, seeing what they can do as far as activism goes, or what do you expect to come out of all of this?
That's a really good question. I mean, from what we've seen, a lot of employees have shown support for the fired workers. So mm-hmm. once it became, so a couple of the Google employees who were recently fired, they were placed on leave first. And when that happened, hundreds of employees walked out in protest to sort of give their support toward them. And it's hard for me to imagine some of those employees won't continue protesting what they see as something that's not right. But, you know, if Google is cracking down and does continue to do so, it's hard to predict whether that will effectively deter them from doing more in the future.
And has it changed the employee handbook at all in response to this?
Yeah, after that walkout that I mentioned, Google came up with a new policy around reporting harassment, around employee conduct. So they did make some changes, but I think it didn't go quite as far as some employees wanted. And the rank and file employees, like I said, are still pushing to make sure that the company takes things like human rights into close consideration. And I don't think that they've had all of their demands yet met, which is why we're still seeing protests from them.
Well, Colin Letcher, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you.
That's Colin Letcher. He's a senior reporter for The Verge. He covers government tech policy and employee activism in the tech industry. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Facial recognition technology is considered an asset when it comes to solving crimes and as a countermeasure against threats in public venues and to identify people at ports of entry. But a new government study has confirmed that the technology also misidentifies Blacks, Asians, and Native Americans at a much higher rate than whites. Drew Harwell is technology reporter for The Washington Post. He covers this issue. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks.
All right. So what this isn't new, that this problem with facial recognition. What did this study find this time?
Yeah, this has been something that independent researchers have been, you know, pointing to for a while. But now we have kind of the imprimatur of the federal government, which did, you know, this long running study with most of the algorithms that are used for facial recognition today across the country. And what it found is that there's a huge racial bias in how accurate these searches are. For Asian and African American people, their faces are up to 100 times more likely to be misidentified by these systems compared to a white person. And, you know, and so there's a huge risk of misidentification. And, you know, these systems are exploding across the country. So that's pretty worrisome.
Yeah, awful bias. And so how is law enforcement, how is ICE, how are all these entities responding to this?
So their point, I mean, and they have been making the argument for a long time that this bias does not exist. I mean, in their argument and the argument of the sort of tech industry, the more you use it, the better it'll get and the more images it'll see. But here we have, you know, that this is a system that's already in place.
Right.
you know, so it's a problem here and now, right? And so that's the question of how important it is now that one that CBP is having to answer for.
Who did this study and how significant is it going forward?
So this was done by this federal lab called the National Institute of Standards and Technology. They're a group that no one has ever heard of, but they're extremely influential in the government. They study all of the federal algorithms that are used across the government, and there's a lot of them, surprisingly. And they come to it from a totally sort of, you know, regulatory standpoint. They don't have an axe to grind. So to hear it in their words that there is this bias, I think it goes to show that this is a real problem. This isn't just some, you know, political football here. There's a real problem, and it's affecting how police are doing their searches and how people are being identified.
Why is there the bias? What is it happening to these algorithms that is causing this problem?
Yeah, so these researchers did not come to a conclusion on what the problem was. But in previous research, the thought has been, as data scientists say, garbage in, garbage out. Mm-hmm. You have a certain amount of data that you put into the system to train the algorithm to know what faces, the difference between different faces. So if it's trained on a bunch of white faces and not that many of anybody else, it's going to have that much more precision with white faces and be that much more inaccurate with others. So, you know, the worry is with a lot of these systems, they were trained on, you know, big databases of images that were online already. A lot of them already had sort of a racial bias in that they were over-indexing for white people. And so those biases are now getting baked into the system. So as, you know, now for any sort of person of color on the street, they're that much more likely to be misidentified without them even really knowing.
So I was talking about this problem with the algorithms and the baked-in biases years ago with folks. Is there any way to catch up and rectify it, or is it these sort of biases that become implicit, just like we talk about implicit bias in humans?
Yeah, it's a good question, right? And they're in the middle of sort of addressing it now. I think there is some. For how these algorithms are trained, there are some simple fixes you can do, including just adding more balance into the data set, right? Having more faces of different kinds of color. But there, you know, that's not really proven just yet. And how long does it take to get to that point of parity? Will we ever really be at parity, or will there always be a gap between how different faces are identified? And, you know, whenever we talk about accuracy, people always point to the fact that, well, hold on a second. If the government needs more accurate faces and they end up having to surveil lots of people to get them or pull in a lot of, you know, different faces of different ethnicities, maybe that's its own issue, right? Maybe that brings up all of these other questions about facial recognition in terms of, even if it's super accurate, is it what we want? Do we want this sort of government surveillance system that can identify anybody from afar?
Well, be that as it may, that's what we have now, right? It's everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's something you're seeing in airports more often, right? It's in your phone. You know, it's being used in schools more often and companies to allow people into the office. It's this technology that has outpaced its accuracy, really, and outpaced the laws. There's no real great federal regulation binding these sorts of systems. So it's kind of the Wild West in terms of how different groups want to turn it on.
I'm wondering, though, in our courts, if it goes the way of the lie detector test, where it's useful, but it's not evidence anymore.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good analog. And some people have even compared it to, you know, fingerprints as well.
Yeah.
Facial recognition, in some minds, there's this sort of sci-fi connection, and the tech companies push this as well. There's this sort of vision that it works flawlessly, right? You just put a face in and it automatically tells. But, you know, these systems are imperfect. And those imperfections mean something in a country where police are now using this to identify potential suspects in a crime. You know, airports are using this to determine who might be, you know, appropriate to fly and who might be a terrorist suspect, mm-hmm. right? And so any one, you know, even a 99% accurate system based in a country that's more than 300 million people is going to catch some people in that gap. So, Yeah, it's not a flawless system, and it may not be for a long time now. So we have to reckon with the fact that who are these people who are going to get flipped through the cracks, and what can we do to rectify that?
And who is working on that? The ACLU? I mean, are there organizations? What's going on?
So the tech companies are all sort of coming at it in their own separate ways. A lot of them have, sort of highlighted the fact that they are trying to have more equitable data sets, right, of people of all different ages, genders, ethnicities, races, you know, national origins. And in their viewpoint, they feel like what we can do is add more training, get these systems more refined to a point where they are accurate. And, you know, the government is trying to do this as well. And tests like this by NIST that sort of set a metric in which different algorithms can sort of compete for accuracy, that's a big step toward it. But, you know, we don't really know what the right amount of accuracy is, right? I don't know that
we
we'll
don't know what's
really
causing
get
the problem, ultimately.
Right.
We're just guessing at this point.
Yeah. And until we can really get to 100% accuracy, which may be a pipe dream, there's going to be these inaccuracies and there's going to be people sort of caught in the middle.
So you're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Again, we're talking about facial recognition technology and how there is it's been shown once again that there is a bias in it, and that it misidentifies people of color more often than white people. There was a landmark federal study released, looks like earlier in December, and I'm talking with Drew Harwell of the Washington Post, who covered the issue. If you have a question or comment, do you use the facial recognition technology on your phone, on your iPad, or whatever whatever technology? Are you comfortable with it? What do you make of it? 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Was there a distinction made in the study between Asians and African Americans and other people of color?
They did. They tested a bunch of different ethnicities, and what they found was fairly interesting in terms of Native Americans, American Indians were often the most often misidentified. African Americans, Asian people. There was just a huge sort of gap between kind of what the system saw as the standard face, right? A middle-aged white guy was kind of what the system saw as a default. And then everybody else was shades of inaccuracy separated from that. But there was one interesting thing that they found, which is that they tested algorithms that were sort of developed in the U.S., and they also tested a lot of them that were developed in Israel and China, which are also big sort of AI centers. And what they found in China was, people who came from China or Japan or sort of Asian faces were that much more accurate. So that kind of bolstered the argument that it's all about the data, right? It's all about how these systems are trained, who they're looking at when they're trained. And it sort of suggested that maybe there is a way to refine these systems in a reasonable amount of time.
Has anyone suggested, it seems to me that I've heard this before, that it was actually the color of the skin that is causing part of the problem?
You know, that has been one theory, right? And, you know, there's an interesting sort of through line of racial bias in a lot of different technologies. Just imaging devices we have and cameras, for a long time, they were tuned to one shade of skin, right? And so people of color, people with darker skin, you would see these stories of people who would even sort of, wave their hand underneath the motion detection sinks and bathrooms, and they had dark skin and they wouldn't be recognized.
Huh.
Because that was how the systems were designed, and that's how they were tested. This wasn't a flaw that they mandated, right? But it
right.
was just something that this is what happens when you have a tech industry that overindexes on white guys, right? I mean,
yeah.
these are the sorts of side effects you end up having. So there is a racial bias in these, but there's also sort of a bias in gender, right?
And I was going to ask you about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Women were more misidentified more often than men. Young people, older people were misidentified more often than sort of people who are middle-aged or 20 in their 20s or 30s. So it just goes to show that, if you don't have an even playing field, right, and if you have way more of one type of person than another, you're going to have this kind of algorithmic discrimination playing out.
Let's get to some calls real quick here. Dick in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Dick.
I was just curious. I remember in the aftermath of the San Bernardino attacks, they got an iPhone from the gentleman, and there was a big to-do about whether or not Apple would open it up for him using his passcode. I'm curious now, with facial recognition software, whether or not police or law enforcement are able to, you know, confiscate something like your phone and hold it up to your face to then open it and access your data.
Or rip your eye out or something like that. Yeah. What about that, Drew Harwell?
That's a great question, right? And it goes back to this question of can a police officer sort of mandate that you give your fingerprint over or give your face print over? That's a debate that's sort of rolling out right now. Obviously, the sort of police agencies feel like they should be able to mandate that. You know, if you're in custody and if they have your phone, your face is in public, right? They should be able to take that in the same way that they can sort of take the DNA off of a cup that you throw away. It's kind of a public good. But, you know, again, we don't really have a great federal framework for what's allowed and what's not. So these police agencies in different jurisdictions are kind of following their own guidelines, and it changes from one city to the next.
So that federal study and the federal arm, the arm of the government that did the National Institute of Standards and Technology, they just do these studies. Did they put forth any recommendations?
They just do these studies. They give the information to Congress. I mean, in a functional Washington, they would give the information to Congress. Congress would take that and decide which policies are right to pursue. They don't sort of outline these are the steps you should take. But, you know, some members of Congress have seen this kind of study and sort of seen the criticism that's been rolling for the last several months, mm-hmm. and said, hey, this is a reason to catch our breath here a little bit, right? Let's take a pause and let's mandate certain, maybe even just metrics for accuracy, right? Like, what do we want? How accurate do we want an algorithm to be before
you
roll
can,
it out,
yeah,
and turn Americans into guinea pigs for these systems? But we'll see, you know, whether these lawmakers will actually turn this into action or whether it'll just be more criticism.
If they did turn it into action, what agency would oversee such a thing?
That's a good question. So NIST is actually a Department of Commerce agency, but, you know, there are a ton of different agencies throughout the government that use facial recognition in different way. There's obviously Department of Justice and the FBI who use it for, you know, criminal investigations. There's Customs and Border Protection and the Department of Transportation who use it for, you know, flying travelers, people crossing the border, even some of these sort of in-state facial recognition highway systems. So there's this patchwork of different agencies who all use it in different ways. And of course, just to make it even more complicated, a lot of these different agencies use different algorithms. So they use different software to potentially get the same result. So, you know, for a federal framework to really make sense, it would have to capture a lot of these different agencies. So you begin to see why we haven't seen something like this actually take off.
So in the realm of the federal government, even the agencies within the government don't use the same algorithms.
Right. Not always, because these algorithms are made by different contractors. The contractors then have specific deals with these different agencies. There are some, like when you think about the facial recognition systems that we're now seeing in more airports, CBP has said that they want almost all travelers to be go through a facial recognition process at the gate to verify that it's them with the passport, to minimize mm-hmm. passport fraud. They use one specific type of algorithm run by this company, NEC. But that algorithm may be very different than the one that Amazon sells called Recognition that's now used by police agencies across the country in sort of a local jurisdiction. That's why when they do tests like this, you'll see even a different level of accuracy between those different software. So you may be totally misidentified at the airport and perfectly accurate at the police station, and you may not know either way.
Let's see. Bill in Columbus, you're on the air with Drew Harwell of The Washington Post. Go ahead, Bill.
Oh, thank you very much. My question is that I have facial recognition on my telephone, on my computer. is that information being uploaded and used to help improve these systems or used in any way without my knowledge?
It's a great question. So, you know, the two bigs in cell phone software have a little bit different policies. Apple, with their iPhone and Face ID, they have sort of taken a more kind of privacy-focused stance where they say, you know, when you scan your face, it becomes not just an image, but it becomes like a long line of symbols. And that hash mark is what they call, is then sort of kept on your phone just to allow you to unlock it. It's not sent to Apple. But, you know, Google and some other companies have sort of used those images in some ways to refine the system. So the more, you know, images in aggregate that they have, the more precise the algorithms can be. And that's something you see from a lot of these systems. They depend on a ton of people uploading their own data, be it faces or text or whatever, to train these systems and refine them going forward. But that's another thing. Do people know really how their images are being used? Are they okay if it's being used, even in this sort of mass kind of aggregate, wide-scale way to train the systems for the future?
And have there been any legal ramifications from this? Have people who have been misidentified by an algorithm, do they have any legal recourse? Do they have standing?
That's where we're at right now, right? And that's what's really interesting. When I went to Oregon last year to hang out with some of the officers and one police force there that was using Amazon's facial recognition to, you know, if they got surveillance video from in a store, somebody had stole something, they could run it through their system and it would spit out, hey, this person was arrested a couple years ago, let's bring them in again. And in that case, you know, the suspects, the people who had been arrested, wouldn't always even know that facial recognition was used to identify them. Huh. And so that was a big issue from their attorneys, right, and their public defenders who were saying, whoa, let's take a pause here, because how do we even know that the algorithm was accurate in identifying this person? And if we don't even know that the system was used, how can we really fight back? How can we cross-examine it in court? I think we're going to be seeing that more, and you're seeing sort of action from groups like the ACLU, which is saying this is not an appropriate thing to be using in determining people's lives. But, you know, there again, there's no law, there's no legal recourse if you get misidentified. It's just by case basis.
That's becoming a theme, a recurring theme, and in a lot of conversations I have about tech, is that Congress is just unwilling to, at this point, do anything about anything. Unlike, say, the European Union. Again, one more question. Sorry to keep you, Drew, but
no,
has the EU come up with any kind of rules and regulations in this regard?
So they are, as you may guess, a lot more strict in terms of a lot of different planks of tech regulation, but especially sort of facial recognition. But again, there are different sort of jurisdictions, all with their own different policies. London and England, of course, they have a huge sort of facial recognition infrastructure there. There's parts of London where there's just dozens of cameras, and some of them are hooked up to their own sort of facial recognition system. It's not anywhere close to, you know, Beijing or parts of China, which are kind of the leaders in digital surveillance. But, you know, it's getting closer. And again, the frameworks are very different than what sort of a full EU may prefer. So, I think that's going to be the big sort of debate going forward. What are the different national guidelines, policies on how appropriate this kind of surveillance is, and what are we okay with trading off in terms of maybe better security, better privacy, or better surveillance for sort of giving our faces away?
Drew Harwell, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Drew Harwell, tech reporter for The Washington Post. We'll post a copy to his article. It's all the way back from December 19th about how a landmark federal study release showed that facial recognition systems misidentified people of color more than white people. And we come back more with more Tech Tuesday with Russell Holly of Android Central. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Russell Holly is on his annual jaunt to Las Vegas to cover the Consumer Electronics Show, and I saw him hanging out with a robotic suitcase on Twitter earlier today, and hopefully you can explain those shenanigans. Welcome back, Russell Holly.
Hi.
What were you doing with that little suitcase?
So this suitcase is really kind of cool. It starts with a bracelet that you you put on your wrist, and the suitcase has a battery built into it and a little motor and some cameras, and the cameras actually take a picture of you, basically. And then follows you around. So the cameras, it's not connected to Bluetooth or something like that. It's intentionally following you, the image of you, as you walk through an airport. So I walked through a busy convention center hall to see how well it would hold up. And you know, historically, these have had trouble, you know, kind of getting lost and wandering off. And you kind of don't want your suitcase to do that, especially in an airport. So I was a little curious to see how this would work. And it still has some problems, but it worked really well. The cool thing about the bracelet, the idea is that you're supposed to be able to confidently walk through an airport and just know that it's behind you. But if it ever gets more than 2 feet away from you, the thing on your wrist will buzz and let you know that it you know, is no longer as close to you as you thought it was. So in the video that I took, you'll see me kind of constantly looking behind me, like nervously making sure that it was there.
Yeah.
The idea is that you wouldn't have to do that because you're wearing that bracelet to let you know that it is still safely behind you. But honestly, you know, I'm still a little nervous about walking through a busy airport where anyone could just kind of scoop up my bag and leave, and it, you know, it's not going to say much.
It reminded me, and I told you this off the air, of the robotic pram that the baby Yoda, that the baby Yoda or stroller or whatever you want to call it, the baby Yoda is using in Mandalorian.
Yep, I am not clearly not a Mandalorian. I don't do well with helmets. So I would break that rule pretty quickly and be in a lot of trouble.
If you want to see Russell Holly and his video, check him out on Twitter at Russell Holly. Easy to do. All right. So Samsung surprises with two new phones at the CES. Tell us what's going on.
Yes. So, you know, for the last year now, we've had the Samsung Galaxy S10, the Samsung Galaxy Note 10. These are high-end phones. Samsung releases them every year. You know, you've got, you know, kind of the kind of smaller phone that does a lot of really cool stuff that they release in the spring, and then a much larger phone that they announce in the fall for people who, you know, just kind of need those larger screens in their life. They're usually kind of expensive, and they're not, you know, really for everyone, and that makes it difficult to sell them in places like India and areas of China, where Samsung really wants to start competing with Motorola and Google and some of these other companies, especially with companies like Huawei. Struggling to get that Google certification. Samsung's in kind of a unique position to kind of take advantage of that space. And so it released these phones. This is the Galaxy S10 and the Galaxy Note 10 Lite. These phones are less expensive by design, and the way that they accomplish that less expensive design is that the parts on the inside are not as capable. The processor is a little less powerful. It's got a little less storage. The cameras aren't quite as good. But they all come together to make this you know, really nice-looking phone. That is, you know, better suited for that kind of $300 to $400 price range.
So it's giving an option, but you're giving up some quality, right? I mean, what do you think about what you're giving up? Is it worth it?
Yes, absolutely. These are similar in design to what Google did this year with what it calls the Pixel 3A.
Mm-hmm.
In that these are, you know, these are phones that are designed for people who just don't need the top of the line everything. They, you know, they don't need the absolute fastest processor. They're not going to be playing the most intensive video game on it all day, every day. They just want a decent phone that has a good camera. And Samsung's cameras have always been very good, but they're often attached to these phones that are just prohibitively expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that this design will, in theory, resolve. We haven't been able to spend a ton of time with the cameras to say, you know, with certainty, but that's kind of the hope there, is that, you know, by being able to offer just a phone with a decent battery and good camera for a much lower price point, that they'll be able to, you know, pick up a lot more people.
You've got me with decent battery and good camera, because that's what people use their phones a lot for, or they need, you know, reliability in terms of the battery, and they want a good camera. But are there any drawbacks?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest drawback there is that it's, you know, it's still, you know, kind of an all-glass phone.
Okay.
And that for people who usually are used to those kind of less expensive phones, they're used to them being a little more durable.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be interesting to see, you know, how clearly people who buy these phones know that they really need to take the phone and immediately put it in a case in order for it to last for a while. Because when you buy a phone like that, you kind of need it to last for a while.
they have plans to unveil another phone in February. What are the expectations for that?
This is the phone that we were talking about earlier, where, you know, the springtime release where Samsung, you know, gets out on stage and says this is, you know, kind of the best that we can do right now. This is a huge top-of-the-line thing. It'll be the Samsung Galaxy S11, which will, you know, it's their big thing every year that they talk about, you know, kind of the best cameras and the best display and what they have done to kind of push the state of the market forward.
You wanted to talk about augmented reality glasses. We know what augmented reality is. Refresh our memories, though, and what's the usefulness here?
Yeah, so augmented reality takes the real world that you see around it and lays digital stuff over top of it, where virtual reality allows you to put yourself in a headset and just remove all of the gross, yucky reality around you and replace it with something cool. This takes the actual reality and kind of overlays some interesting things on it. So, you know, this has been a technology that we've had for a while. It starts with something simple like being able to use it for mapping directions or to, you know, to place, you know, kind of a fun character on a table for a kid to play with. Or even just Snapchat filters, you know, being able to place, you know, silly glasses on your face when you go to take a picture. These are all examples of augmented reality. But they all require you to stare through your phone in order to do something. And the big kind of future thing that tech nerds like me have been talking about for a couple of years is removing your phone from the equation and just making it a set of glasses that you just wear. And that way, when you walk around, you just see these virtual objects in the real world that you can go and interact with.
Okay. So, what is this something that came out of CES?
This is something that has been in development for a little over a year now from a company called Nreal. This is the Nreal Lite. This is a set of glasses that you put on and then connect your phone to, and it gives you all of your apps that are on your phone in a way that you can, you know, kind of experience them immediately in front of you. Instead of having to hold your phone up, you can take YouTube and just put it on the wall on the other side of the room, and then you just look at the wall, and YouTube is there for you to watch videos on what appears to be a 200-inch screen on a wall that everyone else would look in to see that it is a normal wall. Or you could sit down at your desk right where you are right now, and right next to your microphone could be your Instagram page or, you know, your Twitter account or something like, or just show notes that would just kind of float right there next to the microphone for you to be able to kind of read and interact with. But you're the only one who can see them because they are being projected through those glasses.
All right. So what do they look like?
They look like a goofy set of sunglasses.
Okay, here we go.
You know, they're bright orange. They're a little on the thick side. These are not glasses that you are going to wear all day, every day. These are glasses that you could sit down at a desk, or you could sit down on a bus or something like that, and put these glasses on while you are stationary, and be able to essentially replace your computer screen in front of you. You know, these are not heavy glasses. They're 80 grams, but you could effectively put these on and just kind of virtually replace the things that are around you.
I'm intrigued by this. Should I be, or is it a gimmick?
I think this is a really cool idea, and this is coming from someone who has been highly... not, you know, I've been really kind of down on this idea for a while now because the implementations that we have seen up until this point have not been very good.
Yeah.
And Nreal has done a really good job of making it so that it's, you know, it is exactly the experience that you're used to on your phone that you can just kind of put in the world around you. And it makes a really compelling experience. But that having been said, you know, these are $500 glasses that are...
That's cheaper than what I pay for my regular glasses.
Well, these are not prescriptions, so they're a little different.
Okay.
But yeah, these are $500. This is a $500 computer that you wear on your face. So you have to be kind of sure that this is the experience that you want before you set down that money.
How much time have you spent with these?
I've spent a couple hours with them at this point. Testing out a whole bunch of different things, including, you know, we talked about the apps that are available on your phone, but also some things that are designed to take advantage of the space around you. One of them was a game that was really interesting. There's a coffee table next to me in the demo area that I was in, and I looked down at the coffee table, and there's actually two little characters, essentially from like a Street Fighter game, where they're, you know, kind of two characters fighting back and forth against one another. And you could pick up a game controller and play this game that was happening on the coffee table, that you could kind of walk around this coffee table and see from every angle. But again, you know, as the person wearing the glasses, you're essentially the only person who can see it.
But you could have another person with glasses there playing with you.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, these are shared experiences. You can have someone else with glasses, you know, be able to participate in this in several different ways. It's really interesting.
What about Pokemon Go and that kind of a thing?
Pokemon Go is something that, like, that's kind of the vision for what augmented reality could be in the future, and that you're walking around with these glasses, and they're just kind of inert. You're looking at, you know, kind of the normal world around you. You're walking down a street, and then from behind a tree, you know, one of these digital creatures comes out, and you then can choose to engage in that game and interact with that thing. That is not something that these glasses are capable of, and it's probably not something we will see for a full generation. But that is, when you put these glasses on, you very clearly see that that's the direction this is heading.
Huh, interesting. All right, we'll stand by for more on that. This wearable fitness tracker from, how is it pronounced, Suunto?
Yeah, Suunto.
Okay, it looks really cool. Is that your wrist in the picture?
That is my wrist in the picture.
Okay, nice wrist.
Suunto has made for a really long time high-end fitness trackers for people who are very, very excited about fitness, but not a whole lot else.
Yeah, okay.
And that they are great for kind of extreme, mountain climbing or power rowboating or kind of intense cycling and things like that. But they are very much designed to be high-end fitness trackers that give you a lot more information than a Fitbit, and they're priced to match. You know, these are often $300-$500 watches that you wear that give you just a ton of very accurate information. They're designed for people who consider themselves very serious, fitness or kind of extreme sports people. And the versions of these watches that have been released over the last couple of years have been really great at that fitness tracking thing, but not really great at being smartwatches. And in a world where, you know, we see Apple being able to make, pretty good fitness trackers that are also great smartwatches, it's hard to sell someone on that idea. That they need two watches essentially if they want a smartwatch and a great fitness tracker. So Suunto worked with Google to make a version of their high end fitness tracking watch that also runs the Wear OS operating system, which means it gives you all of the smartwatch functionality that you would get from a normal kind of Android Wear smartwatch, as well as all of these high end fitness features that you would want on your wrist if you are interested in those kind of high end experiences.
It has a mapping app on it, right?
Yeah, so Suunto makes a ton of different pieces of software for tracking things, because these are GPS watches, and a big part of that is being able to really accurately track, when you're not on, kind of a street corner, if you're running up the side of a mountain or something like that, being able to provide you with, accurate elevation information and how fast you're going and where you are kind of in the world. In the past, Suunto watches have done this in kind of a black and white or grayscale or very limited color, scheme. In order to save power or because that was the capabilities that the watch had at the time, they, maybe weren't full color watches, for example. But because Wear OS watches have a full color display, Suunto, the people making this were actually really excited about being able to have a version of this software that was fully color and could provide a lot more information about the environment around you as you were moving through it.
Well, I love the mapping on it. I don't even know if I can do that with my Apple Watch. Can I?
No, there are apps that will give you some information like that, but again, it's nowhere near as accurate as what you get from the people at Suunto.
Okay, cool. And you said it's like what, $400?
These are they start at $499. Oh. They're available for pre-order now. They're going to start shipping by the end of the month.
Okay, and is it water resistant? Can you swim in it? Can it do all of that too?
They are extremely water resistant. They are designed to go down to 5 atmospheres in water, which is enough for people who swim, but not enough for people who dive.
Okay.
Is kind of an interesting distinction to make. They are designed to withstand negative 30 degrees Celsius temperatures, if I remember correctly, and upwards of 140 degrees Fahrenheit per heat.
Well, we didn't have time to talk about Dragonfly, the new laptop from HP, but maybe next week?
Absolutely. There's going to be plenty to talk about next week.
All right, cool. We'll have fun at CES.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. That's Russell Holley, contributing editor for Android Central. And that's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks so much for listening. You've been listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.